So we're starting our study session today with the first teaching from the Kadampa precepts collected from here and there. And it's a teaching from Atisha about the precept of the Lama. I want to say a little bit about Atisha and the context in which these teachings are emerging before I look at the actual text. So Atisha is about the 11th century from Bengal in India. He was a remarkable Buddhist teacher. He's one of the figures on our refuge tree. Hugely important and influential. He was a great yogi, great scholar, great teacher, great practitioner in all kinds of ways. He was at the great monastic university of Vikramashila in Bengal, and he really comes out of what you could call the high noon of late-ish Indian Buddhism. Indian Buddhism at its sort of peak. He also had a very important period in his life studying and practicing in probably somewhere like Sumatra, the Golden Island, where his teacher was somebody called Dharmakirti, who taught him the famous bodhicitta mind training teachings, which is a very, very celebrated teaching. And one of the stories I like about that particular teaching, well, apparently when Atisha was in Tibet, when he mentioned his different teachers, he always made particular salutations to his teacher Dharmakirti, and his disciples asked him, well, why do you do that? He said, well, because anything of bodhicitta, that is the force of wisdom and compassion, any bodhicitta in me has come from his teaching, because he trained me in that particular teaching and how to apply it to my life. And he said, every time I saw him, when I was studying with him, his first question, any time during the day, have you developed the bodhicitta? Have you developed wisdom and compassion? Are you blending wisdom and compassion into all of the affairs of your life in body, speech and mind? I mean, every time he saw him, several times a day. I mean, imagine that you went to see your Kalyana Mitra or your local order member, and that was their question every time. You probably find it quite irritating, but Atisha didn't. He found it very inspiring, and developed bodhicitta. And the other very important aspect of Atisha, of course, is that he was instrumental in the revival of Buddhism in Tibet in the 11th century. Buddhism had been initially transmitted in the 8th century, and after an initial flowering, had entered quite a period of difficulty. And even persecution. And Atisha was one of the great teachers who returned to Tibet three times to really establish the foundations of Tibetan Buddhism as we know it, him and his disciples. He's crucially important in the transmission of the Dharma. You could even say that the basic sort of layout of the path and all the practices of all of the schools of Tibetan Buddhism really owe an enormous amount to Atisha, particularly the graduated path to enlightenment. He is so, so crucial. And it seems he was something of a bodhisattva. There's a very good talk by Banti called A Life for the Dharma, where it's a talk inspired by Atisha's life. And one of the things, details in Atisha's life, is that he was invited to Tibet, and he wasn't sure whether to go or not. And he had a vision of Tara. Green Tara was his patron deity, his meditation deity. And Tara said to him, if you go, it will shorten your life, but you will do great good for the Dharma. So there was really no choice for Atisha but to go and teach the Dharma, even though it would take years off of his life. So there was a real sense of doing the right thing, the best thing for the Dharma, a genuine renunciation within the context of altruistic activity. Very inspiring figure. And what we have with these precepts collected from here and there are records of, if you like, his personal conversations with his direct disciples, particularly Drontonpa and his brothers. Drum was Atisha's direct disciple who took over the lineage from Atisha, as well as other teachings by Drum himself and other disciples. And it was obviously an oral transmission that was handed down and then recorded and written down, and has become quite an important little set of teachings, the Kadampa precepts collected from here and there. The Kadampa school really got going after Atisha. It was Drum, his disciple. Interestingly enough, Atisha was a monk, a bhikshu. Drontonpa was a layman. I don't know what kind of layman. I mean, he seemed to have lived in a monastery, but apparently he had a wife and a family, which is quite an interesting detail. But you'll notice his teachings are as uncompromising as Atisha's. But it is quite illustrative, I think, of this whole idea that the Dharma is, you know, for everybody, regardless of lifestyle, if you like. But don't think Drom was living a sort of part-time Buddhist life. Although he was a family man, it was quite clear that his whole life was dedicated to practicing and realizing and teaching the Dharma, as well as organizing the Dharma in Tibet. Very important figure, Geshe Drom, often identified as an emanation of Avalokiteshvara himself in later tradition. So very much associated with great compassion. And the Kadampa school, it sadly died out as an independent school in the 16th century. There's all sorts of murky political reasons for that. But its influence flowed into all of the schools. All of the schools of Tibetan Buddhism really based themselves on the basic Dharma teachings, on the Kadampa. And what's interesting is to notice the kind of things they emphasise. Bhante feels that Tibetan Buddhism, at the time Atisha and Drom were teaching, was a bit of a mixed bag, because
you know, things had been kind of broken up after the 8th century. You had some very profound teachings, some great practitioners, but there was an awful lot of dross and a lot of confusion. And one of the things that you can even see in some of these particular teachings is Atisha and Drom are very, very concerned to get Buddhist practice onto the right track. There's all sorts of weird kind of tantric stuff, you know, going on, all sorts of rationalizations, all sorts of dodgy behavior before, you know, going on when Atisha and Drom were teaching. But they're very, very concerned to, if you like, really, you know, give the true foundations of Dharma practice. So you'll find a great emphasis on renunciation and going for refuge, on the arising of the bodhicitta, on the practice of the six perfections, on the classic meditation division of shamatha and vipassana. I'll be saying something about that later on in the week. Very, very important that you have the correct view of voidness or emptiness, shunyata, not a nihilistic view or an eternalistic view or a view that is one-sided, that is divorced from proper behaviour, proper action, proper attention to karma and its effects, and not divorced either from love and compassion. It's a tremendous emphasis on basic teachings. It's interesting to see the texts that they emphasised as well. Bodhicaryavatara, the Udana Varga, which is sometimes called the Tibetan Dhammapada. It's the verses from the Udana and from the Dhammapada collected in a Sanskrit text. So very, very basic teachings like that. The Great Perfection of Wisdom Sutras and other texts besides. And it's interesting that the meditational deities that they emphasised, a particular sort of set of figures that they really emphasised, at the centre is the Buddha. The Buddha as the teacher. This again is really interesting given Bhante's emphasis over the years, that the centre of their sort of mandala of deities is the Buddha himself
as our primary teacher, as our original teacher. And then they emphasize Avalokiteshvara, Tara, and a wrathful figure named Achara. So it's the sort of basic figures, if you like, not all the sort of weird and wonderful and extraordinary sort of tantric figures. Indeed, Drom Tompa himself told a teacher that he should not teach publicly the Yab Yum forms, these Buddha forms which are depicted in sort of sexual union. He said, because Tibetans just misunderstand it, they get the wrong idea, don't teach it. So a real emphasis on the basics and really clarifying what the Dharma is and how to practice it. What we're going to look at today is this first teaching, which is indeed about the precept of the Lama. So I'm just going to go through it and comment on it a bit as a basis for your study. In a way, one of the things we're going to be looking at here is well, we'll see what we're going to look at here as we go through it. So the precept of the Lama. When a teacher arrived in Tibet, his three disciples, Ku, Gok, and Drom, asked him, for attaining the high estates and liberation and omniscience, which is more important, to follow the precept of the Lama or to follow the scriptures and commentaries? A teacher replied, the precept of the Lama is more important than the scriptures and commentaries. Why is that? They asked. Atisha said, even if you know that the primary characteristic of all phenomena is voidness and can recite the Tripitaka as well, you and the teaching will be completely separate if you do not apply the precept of the Lama at the time of practice. So let's just pause there. So first of all, let's just look at the situation. You know, we're not given any kind of context. It's when a teacher arrived in Tibet, so it's very, very early on in his teaching of the Dharma, and his three disciples asked this question: for attaining the highest states of liberation and omniscience. Liberation, vimoksha, it's a synonym, of course, for nirvana, for enlightenment. Very, very important that we always remember that the Dharma is about freedom, the taste of freedom. That's how you can tell whether it's a Dharma teaching. Has it got that taste of liberation? Liberation particularly from greed, hatred and delusion, liberation from attachment, liberation from fear, liberation from all unwholesome states of mind, and liberation into loving kindness, compassion, and wisdom, and so on. So it's a very important little detail there. Omniscience here is, I don't know what the Tibetan is, but Sanskrit is sarvajna. Sarvajna, it does literally mean all knowing, but we shouldn't misunderstand this word all knowing. The Buddha is quite clear in the Pali Canon that he didn't know the number of leaves on a tree, which apparently the great Jain founder Mahavira knew. He could tell you, if he looked at a tree, how many leaves are on that tree. The Buddha said, I don't know that. I don't have that kind of knowledge. What the Buddha did know was directly where all paths lead. So if you were to expound to the Buddha what your particular path of practice was, he would be able to tell you directly where that led. Would it lead to liberation or would it lead to downfall? A very kind of humorous example is of the ascetic who practiced like a dog, a canine ascetic who lived like a dog, went on all fours, you know, did all doggy things as a way of gaining moksha. And he asked the Buddha, does this lead to liberation? And the Buddha knew directly and told him directly, if you get it right, you'll be reborn as a dog. If you get it wrong, you'll be sent to perdition, downfall, hell. I think the Buddha had a bit of a smile on his face at the time. That might sound pretty obvious. We would probably be able to say that. But anyway. So it's more this Edward Conza translates Sarvajñāna as knowledge of all the modes, of all the ways of practice and seeing where they lead. The Buddha has that kind of wisdom. What's important in this question is that these three disciples are really keen. They want to know how to gain liberation, how to gain wisdom. Let's leave aside omniscience. How to see things, how to be liberated, how to see things as they are. They're really ideal disciples. They're really very, very keen, and they want to know what the important thing is. And they've obviously heard about this business of the precept of the Lama, the precept of the teacher, which we'll look at in a minute. And they want to know, well, is that which is more important? Because they're also told, they know very well that the sutras and the commentaries, they're tremendously important as well. So they've obviously learned some things about, if you like, Buddhist culture and practice, the importance of the sutras, the importance of the commentaries, but also the importance of the special teaching, the special precept from the teacher, from the Lama. And I think it's worth just reflecting on that a bit, reflecting, as it were, on the disciple or the student, the one in training, the spiritual aspirant. Because that's, after all, where we all are. We're not teachers. We're students. We're, yes, disciples, practitioners, aspirants to the high states of liberation and omniscience of wisdom. In a way, we need to start. You know, if you really want to, as we'll see, hear the precept of a Lama, get the special teaching, we have to look at ourselves. Sometimes people complain that they're not getting the right kind of teaching. You know, this isn't working and that isn't working. And they look externally, try to find a better teacher or a better path. And they can go, this can spend their whole lives doing that. And the first thing, of course, they've got to do is to really look at themselves, really look at their condition in a way to kind of track back, you know, when you first got involved in the Dharma, what inspired you to get involved in the Dharma? What were you really looking for? Go back to that. It's very important to reclaim your original impetus and inspiration. Maybe it was a lot of unsatisfactoriness in your life. Maybe it was that plus a lot of inspiration. You suddenly felt the sense of wanting to really search for something. You sense that there was something more to become. You could feel a sort of potential in you, kind of yearning to express itself and not being able to. And coming across the Dharma, even coming across Tri Ratna, gave you a way of expressing that. So it's very, very important to, you know, to come back to that. It's very, very precious, that initial, if you like, vibration of potential for Buddhahood, Tathagatagarbha, as it's sometimes called, that sense of something stirring in you, that shoot to enlightenment, just stirring, waking up in you. Very important, never ever to lose touch with that. These guys are definitely in touch with that. They know what they're about. They know what they're after. They know what they want. And they're asking a real question of a teacher. So yes, we should be doing the same. And they're going to listen as well. They're going to listen. One of the things that sometimes said in the Tibetan tradition, when you read the great graded path to enlightenment teachings, which all kind of originate with a teacher, they always give this little preparatory teaching on how to listen to the Dharma. When you're at a Dharma talk, when you're in a study group, when you're going to see your teacher, when you're in a gathering of one kind or another, whatever, whether it's something very intimate or more formal, how do you listen? And they talk about first of all, how you don't listen. They talk about the three defects of a pot. Because they're saying, well, the Dharma, listening to the Dharma, is like being filled, like a vessel, beautiful bowl being filled with the pure water of the Dharma. well, it's no good. You're not going to fill that vessel if the pot's the wrong way up. You know, the water's just not going to go inside. So that means, are you really listening? Are you really open and receptive, you know, to the teaching? You know, so, you know, do you really want it? Or are you actually very full up with your own views and ideas? You remember that Zen story that Bhante tells so beautifully of the Zen master filling up the cup of the person who's come to him, and he keeps filling it even though it's overflowing, and the person's horrified, the scholar is horrified, and saying it's full, and the Zen master says, well, yes, and you're full, so I can't teach you, I can't communicate the Dharma to you. So you need to be the right way up if you're going to listen to the Dharma, if you're going to hear the special teaching. You need also to be a pot that's not cracked. Because if you fill a pot that's cracked, the water will just drain away. And what they say about this, it's not just enough to be receptive, you've also got to be concentrated. You've also got to be really listening, you know, really intently, really focusing. Not sort of drifting off and being distracted. That an insight you get into Tibetan Buddhism of what the teaching assemblies would be like, that you don't carry on a conversation with somebody while the teacher is teaching. And these days, presumably, they'll mention mobile phones and all the rest of it. You're actually fully present, really taking in the Dharma, really listening to the Dharma, emotionally present, intellectually present, fully there, taking it in. And then they say that you should be like a pot that doesn't have poison in it. And by poison, they mean wrong views. They're very, very concerned about this. That it's very easy to distort the Dharma if your views are not right, or if you're in a negative state or something like that. You'll get hold of the Dharma in the wrong way, in a way that's actually destructive to you. I mean, they're particularly concerned in the tradition to do with nihilistic views, you know, about wrong views about emptiness, thinking that it means nothingness and nothing really exists and things like that. We're very, very concerned about that. We would say nihilism, materialism, consumerism, all that sort of thing. We actually are going to poison the Dharma if we've got these sort of wrong views. So we need, if we're going to listen to the Dharma, get the precept of the Lama, we need to really look at ourselves, to look at what sort of condition that we're in if we're going to learn the Dharma. I think a very important part of this is also knowing that we have something to learn. Sometimes it seems to me that people don't think that there is really anything to learn. That what Buddhism is, what the Dharma is a way of making your life a bit more comfortable than it is. Just making you a bit less stress-free to carry on quite an ordinary life, really, and you call it being a Buddhist. That's a wrong view. That's turning up to the Dharma, not really being open to what it really does, its great transforming power. So maybe have a think about that when you're in your groups, when you're discussing. Look at your own sort of condition And of course, really recognise when you are like that pot that's the right way up, that is sealed, doesn't have any cracks, and that is completely clean, and really wants to take in the Dharma. And it's thrilling when you're in that mood. One isn't always in that kind of mood, but there are times I notice this when I'm listening to a Dharma talk or I'm reading a text or something like that, and I'm there. I'm fully present. And what happens then is the Dharma becomes, listening to the Dharma becomes, you can see how it can be, a kind of insight practice. Because the words of the Dharma sort of explode in my alert, fertile, open consciousness. And you sort of see or sense the real meaning of the teaching. So really look for that in you know, when you when you practice, not just when you're listening, but when you're reading, when you're studying, when you're communicating. And it's a very, very good little teaching on the defects and of the pot and what sort of condition we should be in. These guys really want to know. Now, Atisha's reply is unequivocal. The precept of the Lama is more important than the scriptures and the commentaries. Now then, first of all, this is an extraordinary statement, because Atisha is someone who will have enormous reverence and devotion to the scriptures, that is, the sutras and the tantras, the word of the Buddha Vachana. He will have tremendous devotion to that and reverence, as well as the commentaries on the word of the Buddha by the great pandits and acharyas, Nagarjuna and Shantideva and you know, all the rest of them. Atisha would have venerated those texts, as would have Drummond, his friends, his brothers. So this is an extraordinary thing to say. The precept of the Lama is more important than the scriptures and commentaries. We're in a different position. We probably haven't got a real sense of the holiness of the sutras and the commentaries. I wonder how many of you actually read the sutras and the commentaries, you know, on a regular basis. And how much you sort of think about them and regard them as having a real weight for you, almost an authority in the best sense for you. How often do you read the Dhammapada or the Bodhicaryavatara or the White Lotus Sutra or the Pali Canon and so on and so forth? So we might have to do a bit of work on really valuing the sutras and the commentaries. Don't have to read lots of sutras and commentaries. I mean, Bhante is very clear about this. Much better to be familiar with just a very few works which you know very, very well, even memorized. You know, if you could really know, say, the Dhammapada, the Udana, I'm saying those because they're quite short texts, quite pithy, and they contain really basic Dharma, basic teachings. If you really know those, well, you're on very, very substantial ground. But Atisha is saying the precept of the Lama is more important than the sutras and the commentaries. And they ask, well, why is that? And Atisha says, even if you know that the primary characteristic of all phenomena is voidness and can recite the Tripitaka as well, you and the teaching will be completely separate if you do not apply the precept of the Lama at the time of practice. When Atisha says knowing the primary characteristic of all phenomena is voidness, I think he means it intellectually. He's not talking about a genuine insight into the emptiness of all things. He's talking about a theoretical knowledge of emptiness, which is fairly easy to establish, actually. You can have a very easy conceptual understanding. And can recite the Tripitaka, you know, so you know your sutras, you know, you can parade your sutras, even
again, I'm not sure how many of us can actually quote the sutras, or even not that far less still recite them, or even intellectually know that the primary characteristic is voidness, but that's another story. You and the teaching will be completely separate if you do not apply the precept of the Lama at the time of practice. So let's try and unpack this phrase. You and the teaching will be completely separate. This is there is a sort of Tibetan idiom. It might even have kind of Indic origin, might even go back to the Buddha as far as I know, of blending the teaching with your mind stream, with your body, speech, and mind. They like this. Keeping at the moment, the Dharma and us are separated. Let's say the aim is to make the Dharma fully and utterly
blended with our being, which means our entire being will be transformed. When the more the Dharma is actually blended with our mind stream, our body, speech and mind, all behaviour, the more the transformation takes place. There's one particular Tibetan teacher who used a very, very homely metaphor. They like their homely metaphors, the Tibetans. They're very practical people. It's like cooking soup. You know, you're cooking soup. Well, you want that soup, everything, to be really blended. You don't want great big lumps of flour in it. You don't want, you know, big lumps of this, that and the other. You want it beautifully blended. And that blending comes through cooking and stirring and tremendous heat and tremendous effort. So that's what's happening with the Dharma. You're trying to make the Dharma fully interwoven with your entire being, so that you become like a really tasty soup. Now the metaphor is running out, isn't it? Rather than having sort of great big sort of chunks of uncooked flour in your being. I think you get the point. So what the precept of the Lama does is to bring that about. So another bit of background here that's very important. This phrase, precept of the Lama, let's try and unpack this. Another translator of this text says, the essential teaching of the teacher, the essential advice of the teacher, something like that, the pith instruction. This is what in some of the translations of the Songs of Milarepa, they talk about the pith instruction of the guru. That's what we really mean by the precept of the Lama. It's not precept in the sense of the five precepts or the ten precepts. It's that essential piece of advice, which is a distillation of the whole of the Dharma applied to you now. That essential piece of advice, which is a distillation of the whole of the Dharma as understood and practiced by the teacher, which is applied to you and your circumstances now. That's what a teacher means by the precept of the Lama. So that implies many things. It implies that you are, first of all, in contact with a teacher, or let's say a Kalyana Mitra, or Kalyana Mitras. You are in close personal connection, you know, with people who are more experienced than you, who are more practiced in the Dharma, more experienced in the Dharma, more knowledgeable in the Dharma, more realized in the Dharma to some extent than you, who actually know you, who actually can see you, and their teaching is for you, applied to your particular circumstances. The teaching could be about anything. It could be to do with meditation. It could be to do with ethics. It could be to do with wisdom. It might even be to do with how you practice within a particular set of circumstances that are going on in your life. It might be to do with dilemmas in your life. It might be to do with your home circumstances, your community circumstances, your work circumstances. But it will be coming from a deep level. It might not be very much. It might just be a few words which are said to you. It might be a bit more than that. But it's a particular way in which the teacher or the spiritual friend sheds light on your situation, on your existential situation, if you like. As a Buddhist practitioner, someone going for refuge, they'll be shedding light on that for you. They'll be throwing you back on yourself, throwing you back on the Dharma. They'll also be pointing to ways that you can actually practice within that situation. And it's going to be for you. This is what the precept of the Lama really is. But the implications are that you are part of a living and vital spiritual community. That's the background to this. A living and vital spiritual community. You're interacting with people. You're interacting with people who have more experience than you. And you're learning from them. Learning how to apply the Dharma to the circumstances of your life now. Because after all, the Dharma is very, very general. Dharma teachings are very, very general indeed. A lot of them are kind of given in circumstances which are very, very different from the circumstances in which we're living now, even though we might be able to relate to the same kind of human context. That has got to be applied to your circumstances now. Not in a trite and superficial way. You know, sometimes you get this, that you get people saying, how can we make it practical? How can we make it relevant? And it's so banal and superficial, the way of doing that. It just completely falsifies the Dharma. It doesn't work like that. The precept of the Lama, the precept of the spiritual friend, comes out of a profound engagement with the Dharma, with the Buddhist tradition, with Buddhist practice and realization, and the circumstances of our life now. So one of the things that in Bhante's commentary on this, he says some really great things about study groups, and you'll be having some study groups later. He said in a really good study group, you leave the group with two or three precepts, two or three essential teachings that have come out of the intense engagement with the study. And he said, this is one for you study group leaders. I don't have to do the study group leading, so on this retreat, you know, a good study group leader, they stands, as it were, between the tradition, the material in the tradition, and people now, and what they're doing is finding precepts, finding essential teachings to apply the profound Dharma to people's circumstances and situations. Tall order, guys, but that's what the man said. That's the precept from our Lama, from Bhante, about study group leading, inspired by this teaching. Gosh, lots of precepts going on at the moment. But yes, it comes out of this intense engagement. My general experience with this, it's not as a study group leader that I go in thinking, right, I'm going to give them precepts now. You know, in that horrible sort of self-conscious kind of guru way, that's pseudo-guru way, that's no good. But the best thing that happens is when everybody is engaging with the material very, very strongly, really trying to understand it, really trying to apply it. And as it were, the precepts, the essential teachings, the way we can apply this particular teaching, emerges actually in the group, almost collectively. Well, it is collective, even if one person is voicing what the pithy maxim or teaching is. It's coming out of that intense exploration of the Dharma together, so that you go away with some real gold. Again, I'm really mixing my metaphors. You know, Shantideva talks about the bodhicitta being like fresh butter, churned from the milk of the true Dharma. But in the same way, I think, you know, these precepts, these essential teachings are a bit like that. A study group should be like, you know, you're doing milk churning together to get the sort of fresh butter of the relevant Dharma, the relevant effective Dharma for everybody now. Precepts will also be a bit challenging. They're going to be a bit pokey. They're not going to necessarily be a consolation. They're going to be quite gnomic, I think, sometimes. They're going to be very practical. They're going to be very concrete. But the really big point, I think, is that they come out of intense communication and living the Dharma life together as much as you can. They come out of an alertness and receptivity to one another, going back to my comments about the three pots. In Bhante himself, you know, there's so many precepts, pith teachings and essential teachings that he's given us. But one of them is about the nature of spiritual community. In a very, very early lecture where he talks about the meaning of going for refuge to the Sangha, he talks about it means going for refuge from mere contact to communication. And he says, by communication, I mean a vital mutual responsiveness.
a vital mutual responsiveness, a common exploration of the spiritual world in complete honesty and complete harmony, where the distinction between the more or less developed loses its meaning. That's his vision of the Sangha, one of his visions of the Sangha. That's what a study group should be like. You're so honestly engaged in that exploration of the Dharma that you forget about different levels of experience. And what will emerge then will be, you know, the pure gold of the essential precepts of the Dharma. So keep that in mind when you go into your groups. Keep that in mind. Study groups are spiritual practices. They're not theoretical sessions. They're spiritual practices, Dharma practices. So, yes, and the aim is to make the Dharma more and more fully, I don't like the word integrated, but more totally inter-involved in our lives. And in that way we will be completely transformed. That's certainly the aim of the teacher. He wants to give you an essential teaching that will transform you, that will change your life. Again, the disciples asked, please define the practice of the precept of the Lama. Is it simply striving to do virtuous deeds in body, speech and mind, acting in accord with the three vows, the vow of individual liberation, the Bodhisattva vow and the Tantric vow? Both of these are insufficient, Atisha answered. So a bit of explanation here. The practice of the precept of the Lama. So they're asking, is it just simply, you know, what the Lama, or the teacher, the spiritual friend wants us to do is to strive in body, speech and mind to practice skillfully the uninterrupted flow of skillful states. Of course, you know, your teacher, your spiritual friend will want you to do that. That's not enough. That's not that, because that could be, Bhante felt that it could be interpreted as sort of external. The precept of the Lama is trying to get right inside you, to give the teaching for you. So it's not enough that of course we're going to strive virtuously in body, speech and mind, but it's not a matter of just going through the motions. And acting in accord with the three vows, the vow of individual liberation, the Bodhisattva and the Tantric vow. This goes back to the sort of Triyana model that Atisha would have followed. So you vow to gain enlightenment, that's particularly associated with going for refuge. You vow to gain enlightenment for all living beings, that's taking the Bodhisattva vow. And the Tantric vow is all sorts of oaths you take, that's the only word for them, oaths which you break in to your great peril, to practice certain arcane practices. And he's saying, well, all of these are insufficient. They're not enough. Again, because they could just be followed externally. But why, they want to know. You know, you can see what they're doing. They obviously know some Dharma. They know some Buddhist culture. They can put that to Atisha. But he's saying, no, that's not enough. And in a way, what he does now, what I think Atisha does now, gives a sort of criteria for what the precept of the Lama might be. He's not saying what it is, because of course it's going to vary depending on circumstances, but he gives a sort of criteria for it. Although you keep the three vows, if you do not renounce the three realms of samsara, your activities will only increase your worldliness. Although you strive to perform virtuous deeds in body, speech and mind both day and night, if you do not dedicate this work to the enlightenment of all, you will end up with numerous wrong concepts. Though you meditate and are considered a holy and wise teacher, if you do not abandon your interest in the eight worldly concerns, whatever you do will be only for the purposes of this life, and in the future you will not find the right path. So as I've said, I think what he's trying to do is give a sort of criteria for what the precept of the Lama is going to do, what the essential teaching should be about, because it will sort of vary. The application of the generality of the Dharma to your personal situation.
Bhante goes into this quite fully in the seminar. He said this is why there appear to be contradictions in the Dharma. You know, you can find the same teacher saying to some of his disciples, make tremendous effort, go very fast in your practice. And then to another set of disciples is go slow, relax. And people get very, very confused. If you go through Bhante's different seminars and lectures, you could probably end them up, you know, different sort of Sangharakshita teachings having an argument with one another. You could probably find it with the Buddha. Because what the different teaching is concerned with is for the particular individuals for who are being taught. It's for their circumstances, their situation. It's not general. In a sense, all precepts in the end are not in conflict, because they're all concerned with the development and transformation of the individual. But every individual is at a different state of development, so they need a different application, a different teaching. This is why we used to get a bit frustrated with Bhante. I remember the famous two seminars here. There was one seminar on the perfection of wisdom, where he talked about the greater mandala of aesthetic appreciation and was emphasizing doing nothing, loving beauty, all this sort of thing. I mean, we missed out some of the other things he said in that seminar, but that was the big emphasis. The next seminar he did, he talked about working hard for the Dharma, even if you didn't feel like it, really working for the good of others. Different precepts for different people, different occasions. Actually, they're not in conflict, but it could seem like that at the time for us. We think, hang on, you said this to this group of people. Why are you saying this to this group of people now? But they're not in conflict because he's talking to a particular group of people. Bhante points out in the seminar that all of the sutras, all of the teachings of Buddhism began as precepts. This is quite important, I think, to understand when we read the Buddhist scriptures. They all start as particular forms of advice to particular people or particular groups of people in particular situations. Then they get turned into sutras. They get turned into elaborate teachings. You might even get systems of practice developing. But then you've got to have the precept coming out of that again to apply the teaching to our actual situation. Bhante himself, you could say, we are founded on the precepts of our Lama. Bhante, over the years, has given all sorts of different teachings. Over time, we've seen that some of them have become more and more sort of central. You know, he's discovered that they are more and more central, like the centrality of going for refuge. Well, he didn't start with that idea. That's something that sort of emerged as he dwelt more deeply on the nature of the Dharma and as he interacted with us. The system of spiritual training and practice began as a kind of off-the-cuff precept. Surita was on the seminar. It was his ordination retreat. He just came in and talked about integration and mindfulness and positive emotion, vision and spiritual death, transformation and rebirth, spontaneous compassionate activity, that kind of thing. Over time, that has developed into our whole system of training and practice. These are just a few examples. It still has to be applied to your particular circumstances. But can you see what I'm sort of getting at? Can you see the kind of creativity in the tradition? This is really, really important that we have a very creative interaction, you know, with the traditions that we inherit. Creative in the sense of really trying to understand them, see what they really mean, not just being clear about them intellectually, but see what they mean in experience, and then apply them to our particular circumstances and to the circumstances of others. But the criteria he gives is interesting, I think. So I think what Atisha is getting at here is that a precept of a Lama, an essential teaching of a spiritual friend, should have very, very strongly the flavour of renunciation. Very, very strongly. Renunciation of the three realms. That's the realm of sense desire, the realm of archetypal or pure form, the sort of dhyanic realms, and the realm of no form or very subtle form, the even higher dhyanic realms. That's the world. That's the samsara. Those three levels, or if you like, dimensions of our experience. And our experience, we know only too well, the world of sense desire and our attachment and craving to sense desire. Maybe we've got little inklings of that more archetypal realm of pure form, dhyana, deeper meditation, and even inklings of a even more refined realm. That is still conditioned. That's still the world. So if that's the world, even those dhyanic realms, what about what we're up to most of the time? So a teaching, a precept of the Lama is going to have this quality of you wanting to really give up and go forth from the samsara, knowing what samsara is, knowing what conditioned existence is. As I said at the beginning, I think very often our attitude to Buddhism is to make ourselves more comfortable in samsara. I've been saying over the last few years that I think that the real shadow side of Buddhism, of Western Buddhism, isn't sort of dodgy activity, it's renunciation. That's the really repressed area of contemporary Buddhism. Why? Because renunciation is about giving up things. Giving up our attachment, giving up things, not just giving up our attachment, but giving up our involvement with all sorts of things. We can think things that so many things are so important, so crucial to our life and the lives of others. And actually, we're just being busybodies with ourselves and other people. And we're just running around in the same old sort of state. I know we have to earn a living, you know, we have to support our families and whatever it might be, live in our communities, work in our centres. But it's very, very important that we're not seeing that Buddhism is another way of making the world go round and round and round, and just giving it a nice rosy kind of spiritual face. That's not good enough. We need to be renouncing. The one of the words for renunciation is nisarana, nisharana, not going for refuge. In other words, not seeing ultimate security in the things of the world. It doesn't mean you despise sunsets or beautiful things like that or beautiful people. That's not the point. But it's particularly, you don't go for refuge. You don't look for security, meaning, making you feel all right from the usual tactics that you use. I feel a bit down today. Oh, I know, I'll go on Facebook. Oh, I'm feeling a bit down today. Oh, I'll watch this film. I'll eat this food. I'll watch this program, whatever it might be, the usual kind of rubbish that we turn to. We really turn to the refuges. That's the other side of renunciation. We see the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha as being those objects that really do work. We see that it's only enlightenment that can really satisfy. It's only the Dharma that can bring about that satisfaction. And it's only the Arya Sangha that could really support us in our endeavours to realise enlightenment. So, you know, we talk about these as going for refuge retreats. Well, we really do have to take that word refuge very, very seriously. And one way we can do that is by having a good look at the nature of our samsara, our particular version of it, and how we might renounce that, how we might stop trying to rely on it, because it doesn't work. It falls apart. It stops happening. You know, you really notice this when you have an illness, or if there's a brush with death, or any kind of loss. You know, something or somebody that you've really relied on. You know, it just doesn't work. And then, of course, you try to do it again. Oh, if I could just do it better next time. Well, when you start to get older, some of us are a bit older here. you realise, hang on, no, it isn't going to work like that. It really isn't. It's all running out. It's running down. I really need to be turning to something quite different from the usual things that I turn to. So a precept of the Lama, an essential teaching of the Kalyana Mitra, is going to have that quality of renunciation. So that your Dharma life isn't just increasing your worldliness, just a nicer version of it. It's actually propelling you out of samsara. Though you strive to perform virtuous deeds in body, speech and mind both day and night, if you do not dedicate this work to the enlightenment of all, you will end up with numerous wrong concepts. So another aspect of the precept of the Lama, he's going to be concerned that you're practicing to gain enlightenment for the benefit of all. So there's going to be altruism in it. There's going to be something pointing beyond yourself, getting you out of your self-centeredness. And the numerous wrong concepts is to even conceive of the possibility of an enlightenment for yourself, of an insight for yourself. That's totally impossible. If it is genuine insight, if it's genuine wisdom, if it's genuine enlightenment, it will involve generosity. It will involve altruism. It will involve compassion. If it's not, it's not insight. Not that. Just be clear about this. Is one of the precepts of Bhante. He said, I just do not believe there is such a thing as an insight and enlightenment for oneself. He said, I don't think it's impossible, because real seeing involves seeing through self and other, subject and object. There's a softening of self and other which results in love and compassion. This is a teaching that we'll look at tomorrow. So it must be getting you out of yourself, getting you involved in practicing the Dharma for the benefit of all. So a precept of the Lama will have that quality in it. And though you meditate and are considered a holy and wise teacher, if you do not abandon your interest in the eight worldly concerns, whatever you do will be only for the purposes of this life, and in the future you will not find the right path. So the eight worldly concerns, or the eight loka dharmas, gain and loss, fame and disgrace, praise and blame, pleasure and pain. This is a very important teaching, I think. Is well worth reflecting on. In a way, I always keep getting to this point and realising I've run out of time. Because I think this is one of the areas where you can really look at renunciation. To what extent are you practicing to avoid pain and just have a pleasant time? To what extent are you practicing to get praise and avoid blame, and so on? Okay, these things happen to us. That's the nature of samsara. These eight worldly winds blow, these eight dhammas of the world, these eight teachings of the world happen. But how much are we really motivated by them? The ideal practitioner and the ideal teaching from the Lama is pointing us beyond that kind of orientation to something quite different. Quite a different sort of space of equanimity, of unconditioned practice, let's put it like that. I've been reflecting quite a lot lately on how much my mental states are conditioned by these eight worldly dharmas, how much I'm affected, how reactive I am, and how that shows how conditioned my dharma life really is. That it's not moving to something unconditioned, as it were, standing in that sort of transcendental dimension. This is a great test, I think, of whether you genuinely have any degree of deeper sort of practice. How much are you motivated by the eight worldly concerns? Praise and blame, I think, is a classic. It's an absolute classic. You know, you're practicing. You're living the life, you're living according to your values, and you get criticised. You get criticised by other people. You get criticised by maybe those who are near and dear to you. You get criticised by other Buddhists. You get criticised by the world. Do you give up? because it's embarrassing, because you feel ashamed, or do you carry on? No, this is the Dharma. This is the right way to practice. This is what I need to do to bring about liberation. Praise and blame. That's a profound one. And there's all sorts in Buddhist tradition about no matter what befalls you in terms of loss, of blame, of pain and all the rest of it, you still practice, because your Dharma life, you're going for refuge, is not dependent upon those things. So the precept of the Lama is going to have that quality to it. It's going to have that quality. You notice the emphasis on renunciation, on giving up the world, if you like, and on compassion. And we'll see that as we go through. I want to end by telling you about a precept that I received. Over the years, I've had the great good fortune of having time with Bhante in different contexts. You know, in the early days, it was a much smaller movement. It was possible to have quite a bit of contact with him when I was quite young. And there's a particular teaching that gives you an idea, I think, of what a precept of the Lama might be. It came in a letter, and it was before I was ordained. I'd written to Bhante a long letter. I'd had my first, I was only, 19 at the time, so, you know, I can be forgiven. But I'd had my first big love affair, which hadn't ended particularly well, and been blown all over the place, and of course it affected my practice, and I was a quite intense, you know, very, very keen to practice beyond my station, doing loads and loads of prostrations and visualization and all that sort of thing. Bit one-sided, I would say, getting ahead of myself. But that had kind of gone by the by a bit, because I was in love with this person. But it had calmed down, and I wrote to Bhante after it had calmed down, and said, you know, things had been a bit rocky, and how did I put it? I talked about it as a period of emotional instability. He knew very well what it was all about. And he wrote back and I asked him various questions about the prostration practice and so on. He wrote a lovely reply giving me instructions about how to do the practice, about what books, recommending a particular book to read and so on. So plenty of precepts there. And then he said, I'm pleased to hear that your period of emotional instability has come to an end. The only protection, an attack of emotional instability, I think, is that the only protection against such attacks are the following things: regular practice of puja, regular practice of meditation, regular study, meeting spiritual friends, regular, obviously, practice of ethics, and selfless service. Selfless service. These six things will not only protect you from some such attacks, they'll be the basis for the development of insight. And when you've developed insight, that will protect you from such attacks. So a very, very clear set of teachings for me. Not, you know, sort of, you know, not, you know, quite recognisable, but there they were. Puja, the whole place of devotion, meditation, spiritual friendship, study, ethics, and this other area, selfless service. In other words, giving myself up to the Dharma, giving myself up to the bodhicitta. That's what I think what he really meant. And that would protect me, regularly doing those things against whatever worldly winds might blow, but also it would form the basis of insight, vipassana, seeing the Dharma directly, and when that happened, I would be protected by that. So I'm passing on to you a precept of my Lama, my guru, my teacher, Urgyen Sangharakshita, given to me at the tender age of 19, and I've never forgotten that teaching. I've given talks on that teaching. I've even given that teaching a name. The what did I call it once? The six special Dharmas of protection. So yes, that tradition of the precept of the Lama is still alive.
I'm sure it's alive for some of you, your Kalyana Mitras, the order members that you're close to. They've given you very, very good pithy advice at times, which you're employing and living from.
So remember the importance, I think, of particularly the intensity of spiritual friendship.
Without straining, of course. But really knowing one another deeply, profoundly engaging with the Dharma and discovering the Dharma for you now in your particular circumstances. So use all that for the groups this afternoon.